Welcome to episode 2 of the VFX Existential Crisis podcast. I've been saying that a lot. And
I'm takes practice.
Getting better at it. This is our second episode. We read an article that we thought was interesting. Maybe, Graham, you could describe what it's all about.
Yeah, so it's from a website called rustoftheworld.org, and actually takes a kind of Asian perspective, or non-North American perspective anyway, on the visual effects industry. And it kind of hones in on the recent deal that Netflix did to acquire Ben Affleck's company. So we're going to talk a little bit about that and a little bit about the implication for work across the spectrum. But I think we're going to start with Chris doing a little bit of a recap of what the front of the pipeline looks like, because not everyone maybe knows what's going on at the beginning of a show.
Yeah, so the article, obviously a large majority of the workforce in India has been set up in the past to deal with high labor, expensive labor tasks, rotoscoping, tracking, paint work, paint preparation of plates, things like that, which for the most part, Western studios didn't want to do at all because it's kind of laborious work for the artists, but also at Western labor costs, it's pretty expensive. So, you know, for, I don't know, like 20 odd years now, that capability has been growing. So a lot of people were outsourcing that component of the work. And then as studios got bigger, they started to create their own Indian locations, which weren't just doing that, of course. They're doing other things as well. But a big component, and especially for entry-level people into the industry, that's where they start. So you cut mats, you track people, and there's not just in India, but in places all over Asia and South America in some cases as well, as far as I know. So as a rule of thumb, when we would get a visual effects project in, like a, let's say a standard TV type show, I would always look at it as if, you know, about 30% of my budget would need to go into that. Now, this is after sort of deciding that we're not going to do it in our local jurisdiction, in this case, Toronto or Montreal or London or whatever. And the reason we would want to do that is, some obvious things. It's cheaper. There's an expertise, frankly, especially after a while, is a high expertise, and a lot more people to do it. So what would have, if we got 100 shots in for an episode and we have a team of 30 people, for 10 of those people who are compositors to chew through 100 shots rotoscoping and or tracking in 3D's case, it would take half the schedule. Whereas I can call different companies and say, hey, I have 100 shots, and they could put 50 people on it and get it done in a week or two, maybe three. The downside would be time. So this would be the challenge, because anytime you're working remote, that was the beginning of remote work, is you're working with people offsite, any kind of a sub vendor, then there's communication issues, it's back and forth. So building relationships with people was super important. Like we had the place I did the most of this with, we had kind of an understanding with the groups that if they needed to, you know, with rotoscope and cutting mats, you can get it 90% of the way, and that extra 10% is kind of fussy, but the compositors usually want to fuss with it anyways. So we kind of set a quality matrix that everyone understood, and then it sort of would build more for speed. If you're working in a feature film kind of environment, you'd maybe want to go more all the way. And particularly when you work with the big studios, that's kind of their expectations. In fact, having been on the other side of that, having been a subcontractor for many different vendors, it's really important to sort of establish that. But in any case, so if you're looking at, say, 30% of your budget goes towards that, then you're looking at complexity and all that kind of things, and you're divvying it out, and And you have to be, in our case, you had to be careful about how much money you're sending out for tax credits. So there's all these factors that you have to kind of build in. But so pretty, it definitely basically allowed you to put more money into the other parts of the shots. It was a good deal for the subcontractor. And you know, we were able to do essentially higher volume, faster. So a company that say like wants to stay around 100 people can stay around 100 people. And also you could say, okay, well, I don't need to keep 30 people on staff in case we have roto. I just farm it out. Now, you know, you deal with all the same problems, like, oh, it's super busy in the world. For a while that was a problem where like people are just too busy. So you'd have to figure that out, navigate that. But in the end, that's kind of where it would end up. So now, presumably with AI and some of the stuff that, particularly in that article, they were talking about focusing on, you know, sort of this boring work, I guess it would be called, like kind of the stuff, the begrudge.
Mechanical work. Let's call it mechanical work.
Body and fender, people used to call it. You know, it's like, stuff no one's really, the non-sexy stuff that no one really wants to do. And the more complicated you have a visual effect shot, the more you have to do. And so the interesting thing is, let's forget about AI for a second, is really all of visual effects has always been trying to figure out better ways to do that work faster and cheaper and whatever. So the vendors themselves, the tool makers, you know, the silhouettes, the nukes, the, you know, 3D studio, the, what do you call it? All the tracking softwares to make it as automatic as possible. And even like, you know, like Nuke has 3D tracking so that you can do it quicker, like all these things. So everyone knows this is a problem and has known for a long time. It's kind of a barrier to entry to the shots. And really everybody wants to be doing the cool stuff and you want to put all your money into that. And then the clients would like to do that, but obviously the vendors would like to do that too. But the clients especially, like, why am I paying, you know, 30% for this just a rotoscope thing? And also, it's also worth noting that it comes up in conversation a lot. So I think a lot of studios have complained about it. This is my own personal view on this. So for a while, if you moved the camera, it was like, ooh, that's a big deal because we got to track it. But at some point, that tracking became pretty inexpensive. But people still, especially production people, tend to hang on to the reasons why it's going to be more complex and cost the client more money. So, but there's a diminishing return there. So like if you train the client to not, they can only do lock the camera, they can obviously, this is pretty, you know, 10 years ago. It's a crappy shot. So to me, it's like, this is the type of thing, but if you think about it, like this kind of conversation that is accumulated on sets and in bid calls and, well, you know, there's a lot of rotoscope and all the green screen and all the patches and all the, your tracking markers on it. Great. It's a lot of like friction and a lot of like, ugh, this again. This is one of the reasons why visual effects is not loved on set as much as it should be. Mm-hmm. Just like, cause you're basically going, that's going to be a problem. Guy, that's going to be, oh, that's broken. You're doing that a lot. Right. And for good reason. But if you imagine, being a director or a producer and you're just hearing that 10 years straight, it's a lot. So really what they want to do is like, how do we make this cooler? Right. So even in as like up a couple years ago, even internally. So when you work in big studios, at least in my experience, the people who are working in those big studios have been in a particular stream for a long time. So the producers are really good at what they do, but they don't really have as much exposure to like what the visual effects work really is. And like a coordinator might have no context for what they're doing. And this is also part of like the industry growing as well. So I've actually encountered where even in our own internal discussions, the amount of rotoscoping and things like that would be considered like, oh, it's a humongous big deal. And then when I've been in those calls, having multidisciplinary experience, I'm like, guys, what you're talking about, you're complaining to the executives about this being like super complex and oh my God, it's going to be really hard and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, but it costs like this much money. It's money, but it's not as much as you think. So these are the types of things that like, I illustrate that because I think that whole attitude has permeated the entire industry. So this is then, it is an obvious target, but it's even more charged because we've been complaining about it for 20 years.
The perspective is out of whack. People think it's this huge budgetary issue to solve when in fact.
Yeah. And then you see amazing solutions to some of the stuff on like Dune where they're like, we don't want green screens because it has a look. It's sort of the DOPs don't love it, obviously, because it's, you know, you're taking green out. So let's do them on brown. So there's always on every set some discussion about how to mitigate those problems, reduce that amount of work, not just because of the work, but because it will look better if it's captured as much as possible in camera. So you have all that. Then you have AI. And then if I'm Ben Affleck, I'm thinking like, well, I want to make movies and I don't want to pay for all this crappy stuff. And like, sorry, everyone who's in the rotoscoping company, but like, if we can do it in AI, let's do it. And frankly, this is what it's really good at. So I would put rotoscoping, 3D tracking. It's pretty good at that. Paint work, so paint reconstruction, tracking mark reconstruction, and for animation, motion capture. I mean, Wonder Dynamics, those kind of things. There's those kind of tools that are out there, and that all of a sudden opens up a whole bunch of opportunity to save money, speed up the front end of the workflow. Every visual effects shop gets, you get 100 shots, and you go, okay, let's go. And then you're like, wait, we're waiting for the roto to be done. We're waiting for the tracking to be done. We're waiting for the stuff. And everyone's mitigating. Okay, well, let's do a garbage roto. Let's do a quick track so we can do pre-visi, post-visi type stuff until that stuff comes in. So there's this whole, like, not only you're waiting for people to turn over plates and you're like going, please turn over plates, turn over plates, because you know you need this runway to get off the ground. So if you could shorten that, you can either offer things much more cheap or better, which because
more iterations,
more time, more quicker. Like a big problem in a TV timeline is, okay, we've got the edit is locked. We're turning over plates. We're showing the studio 2 weeks from now. What will you have? So there's this big panic to drop in, like get rid of all the green screens. This is very common in movies, like the temps, like the preview temps. And I always tried to resist that so that you wouldn't have to do it twice. Cause to me that was crazy. But if you could do even the cheap version with AI quickly, or whether it's AI or just better tools, you can build confidence with your client faster while those little nitpicky things get sorted out in the background where they don't have to see them.
Well, I can't tell you how many times I've had clients complain about where's that shot? And they turned it over like a week ago and it's still getting rotoed and massaged and they should know better, but
you know, even visual effects people will come in and be like, okay, it was a running joke in a couple of places I've worked where it's like, especially when I was not quite at the top of the pyramid, it's like, okay, we got plates. When am I going to see shots? Like, I'm literally putting the package together to send to India to get the rotoscope done. You know, like, I don't know, like maybe a week or two. So anyways, so all that's to say is it's an easy target in the bubble of VFX. It's an easy target for VFX. It's like, oh, that would make us faster, quicker, like potentially better. And you know, like, I don't know whether it's going to like eliminate roto. I think that's probably hyperbolic, but it might eliminate a lot of roto or most of roto or most paint work. And then you have to go in and fix the stuff you need to fix. I think that whole 80-20 kind of rule is probably more where AI will end up. Maybe you'll have one guy looking at tons of roto. It'll free up a comp supervisor's time because they're not having to look for all this stuff all the time. It'll free up VFX supervisor's time. Like, you know, people trying to get away with rotos because they're under pressure. It's like, well, no, we'll have more time to look at it and we'll see it in context quicker, which is in general the magic solution. Show me the cool stuff in context as soon as possible so that we can judge it, because that's what every on-set person wants. They're used to setting up a scene, looking at it, looking through the camera. Yep. And we are removing that from the process. They're trusting us to come back to it. So things like virtual production, live compositing, all those things bring back the control to the above the line people, the directors and things like that, who are inevitably going to make the decisions, and that's what they want. So if we can, you know, give them that faster, great. But the bad news is there's an entire labor force throughout the world that is quite large that is reliant on this work. So to me, whenever I think about AI and visual effects, the first thing I think is, guys, a lot of people in India in particular, because they're just the biggest place around, are going to get hammered. And then in that article you mentioned, my friend Mohsen was quoted, and Mohsen's a great compositing supervisor. I worked with a bunch of times. And he's right. Like, everybody kind of starts in roto and paint, because it's like, you know, it's the, you know, paint the fence of like Karate Kid style. It's how you start, you know, how you learn the basics. When you start in layout, you know, you start a lot with tracking, things like that. So you understand the fundamentals. When that's gone, I think it's going to be pretty hard to break into at least getting a job.
So let me take a step back. I'm just going to introduce the article properly, because I didn't do it at the beginning. But the article is called Netflix's AI Deal Puts the Global VFX Workforce at Risk. The subtitle, a startup founded by Ben Affleck, recently acquired by Netflix, could automate frame-by-frame work done by artists across India, South Korea, and Latin America. It's by Indranil Ghosh, and it's in restofworld.org. And I think it's fascinating because it takes the perspective of these countries who do have a large reliance on this kind of work to sort of build and finance their visual effects capacity. And it's, you know, the article references something like 2 million jobs at risk if this AI technology takes over. And it makes a lot of sense. I mean, it wouldn't shock me that there are 2 million people doing roto and tracking in South Asia. And here is a technology that promises to eliminate roto and tracking. In fact, Interpositive, their software does color grading, relighting, and continuity fixes amongst roto and tracking. So before we started filming, actually, Chris and I were talking about how, you know, Ben Affleck, you know, obviously he's a writer and a director and actor, and he has said, well, AI is not going to replace directors or actors or writers, but it sure can replace visual effects. And at some level, you know, perhaps he's right. I think we get sometimes a little too precious about what we're doing in visual effects. We're just contributing to the story. But I think one thing that chafes is that this expectation that it's going to be completely automated and run without people, I just don't think that's reasonable. I think it's going to be a different version of what we've got now, with fewer people doing the same amount of work, that's kind of what we're going to talk about today. Like, what does this look like, this next version of visual effects with all of these changes coming?
Well, I think you can see some of it. Like, so yes, there will be people doing that, but where are they? Are they arm's length. You know, like that's one of the kind of complaints is VFX is a bit of a black box for a director. So I can't tell you how many times, like I've been on set. I'm not an on-set supervisor necessarily, but I'm usually there as a second, like a vendor side support to the main supervisor. But I can't tell you how many times I've, like, my job is basically for the director to turn around. He's looking at a blue screen, and I've done my work. We've shown them what it's going to be there. He shoots the shot. He turns to me and go, "Do you think that's going to work?" And I'm like, "Yes." And but that is got to be an unsettling feeling. Like, you know, the top end of that team is responsible for delivering an episode, and you won't find out till later if it turned out okay. That's terrifying. And hence, like, a lot of, you know, people who are used to directors and things like that who are used to visual effects obviously get more comfortable with it and they know what to expect and things like that. But, you know, you're not necessarily hiring a director or an actor for their visual effects chops. You want performance. That's the main focus, performance and the overall kind of setup. So this sort of idea that, and this might be a bit of a hot take, but like, I am a big believer in visual effects, and I do think in many times it gets disrespected. There's no doubt about that. And that's partly because of the on-set component of it, that it is not quite a craft officially in many kind of union type setups and on-set. At the same time, I think we also have to recognize there's been a massive boom of this type of work, and it was great. Like, I mean, it was awesome. But if you've been around long enough, there's booms and busts, and visual effects was chief boom for a while. They're mm-hmm. putting out tons of shows, and now they've kind of, like, you know, thought, we're spending too much money, and it sucks. But the sort of logic of it, and you can understand why some of these sort of, like, maybe it's pulled back too much. And that's all inside of, like, and the whole way we consume media is completely different than it was 10 years ago. So I'm not making an excuse for these people, and I have my doubts about AI in general. But if it wasn't AI and there was a nuke tool that could eliminate Roto, they would have done it. Do you know what I mean? It would have been, it's such an obvious target. You know, where things like animation and like lighting and things like that, to me, those are like, there's targets within them, but but, like, that's where, like, you actually get the things that people want.
Yeah.
It's the same for other crafts too. Like, nobody wants to hear or have to spend too much time about all the background rigging to make the set look cool, like all the stuff they have to do for SFX. Like, these are all kind of like the overhead to doing that work, and so we've got to figure out ways to reduce the overhead, and then maybe you'll see, like, what I'd like to see is a little bit more respect for the outcome of visual effects, but also just like an understanding that this is a tool that they can use. And so your job a lot of times as a VFX supervisor or a producer is to sort of make it, like, comfortable, like, or like reduce the anxiety around that process. And if I can show them shots 2 weeks earlier, that's a massive, while they're editing the episode, not after. It's such a huge deal. So
I was at a VES event last week, and it was hosted by Dennis Berardi and Mr. X. They were talking about their collaboration with Guillermo. For those of you who don't know, they have a long-standing relationship, goes back a decade or more. And they were shooting Frankenstein. That was the sort of topic of discussion. And they were talking about how they would shoot on Tuesday. Plates would be back in the studio by Wednesday morning, and they would have a temp version by lunch for Guillermo to look at, just to make sure that he got something he could use in his sort of computational brain. He's like processing it all. And then as long as it got in the edit, then they would move on to the next stuff. And of course, over time, they refined it into the final image. But it created a nice feedback loop where Guillermo could see how things are materializing. But I just can't imagine the pace for the artists. Like, certainly some of them would have been just editorial inserts and quick comps. But the volume of work that would have had to go through that studio, meaning the level of organization, would have been pretty awesome. But that, I think that's the way things are going to go. Like, the best studios are going to be able to come up with really innovative ways to present stuff faster, get input. It is rare to have that kind of direct relationship with a director. That's a pretty envious position to be in, because Guillermo was looking for them to help build the look and the feel and stuff. But yeah, it was pretty compelling to hear them talk about all the different steps they went through and how quick they could iterate. And yeah, it was impressive.
Yeah, like, I mean, that's what you're trying to do with every client, right? Like, so whether you are trying to educate them in the way that you're going to show them and prove that if I show you A, B, and C, you're going to get to the end product. Like, so a good example of that is if I show you a layout of the camera in gray. Like, some clients can handle that. They get it. Okay, that looks cool. Some can't. And then can you do things like, you know, I had the pleasure of working on Expanse for multiple seasons. And so every season we would try to add something else that pushed it closer to the clients, right? So, you know, like a common thing that they skip when you do a layout is you don't show camera motion blur. Well, when you're flying around spaceships that are spinning around, if you don't show the camera motion blur, you're likely to have a problem down the line that nobody saw. So it's always that cost benefit of how much can I show as quick as possible to contextualize and get feedback early. And the earlier you get feedback as the vendor, the more you're confident in what you do. It's all about, I think all of visual effects and animation is about managing anxiety.
Yeah.
On every level.
Yeah, 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 for sure. Budgets and clients and
budget, confident. Yeah. Here's my $1 million worth of work. Here you go. Please don't screw it up. You know, so if you reduce that anxiety and they feel like they're getting what they, or they, or they're getting something better. I was thinking about it today too, is like filmmaking is a weird thing because it starts as a script, you know, and maybe that script had a couple collaborators or whatever. Then it gets passed to a director. So from that script, the writer had a thing in their mind. The director then takes it. The studio then takes it. They kind of come up with a different thing. It's a giant exercise in filtration. And then after it gets past the sort of 10, 20, 30 people, then it goes out to like 300 and all of their interpretations of it on every facet of the show, set design, sound, VFX, DOP, all that stuff. The fact that any movie gets made is a miracle.
Yeah, it's true.
And the interesting thing is that it's like that it comes out close to what, maybe it doesn't come out close to, but maybe it comes out better, maybe it comes out worse. And so that's kind of the interesting exercise. But there's no doubt that everybody, and this is not just a VFX thing, this is a company type thing. The bigger you scale, the further away you are from the decision making.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of industries, including ours, are looking to get it down to the core decision makers. And then the question you have to ask yourself is, are you invited to that part of the discussion?
You're not always.
No. And, you know, that's, I think, going to be one of the fundamental changes, and it's going to be rough because it's happening so fast.
Yeah.
Is that it's like, okay, so you're a specialist in this one thing. Cool. Do I need this one thing? Nope. Cool. Next. Oh, you can do a whole bunch of stuff. Great. That's why I think you're going to, there is an opportunity
to shift back to generalists for sure. Like,
well, for sure that's already, again, pre AI. Every company that gets over 500 people goes, you know what would be great is a group of 30 people I could talk to and who could do the work again. Like ILM had its version, DNEG has its version. They had their little, like, essentially a studio inside the studio.
Yeah.
right? And then, but then the question is, how do you make this group of people who are doing whatever they need to do integrate into this? It's like having special forces with the army. Like, how do they integrate? Yeah. You know what I mean? So that's always kind of the challenge. But in the, at the end of the day, everybody would like to work with a smaller team. And like, I've heard people say, like, you know, people aren't meant to work with 500 people. They're like, you know, it's like within
not wired that way,
you know, like 30 to 50 people, like a platoon.
Yeah.
It's like a, to me, like the best projects I've worked on are when it's like 30 to 50 people.
Yeah.
Cause okay. It's like, you know, everybody, what everyone's doing, they know what you're doing. You can talk to them every day. As soon as you get over that, it's like my experience going from, you know, 30 people project to like 300 people project was like, you say one thing, some people will challenge you, some people won't, even if it's stupid what you said. You know what I mean? So it has this kind of weird scale. Like on the other hand, you can do crazy things. You can put 50 people on a problem and all of a sudden, boom, it comes out.
Right.
But at the end of the day, I don't know that anybody wants to do anything creative at that scale. And so all of these tools and all the impetus for these tools, aside from money making, which is, you know, that's a big one, the creatives are interesting in it because it makes the group smaller. Mm-hmm. And they can bring in people they can trust. Now, I'm not so sure about Ben Affleck's assertion that it won't touch writing and acting.
Yeah. Isn't there already a agency repping a virtual actress? I mean,
you're going to see it in music first. There's like a mass, this drives me insane, is like, you can see, like, it's audio is a little simpler because you're not dealing with both, but and there's obviously tons of music to learn off of. So, and there's a thread of like, you know, pop culture music, which is formulaic,
mm-hmm.
which a lot of people enjoy. So there's already a complaint about the fact that this is formulaic and the cookie cutter. And it's like, there's whole,
here we go again.
Yeah. It's like New Kids on the Block, Backstreet Boys. These are, you know, that K-pop, there's a formula to them. So they
just lost us 5 subscribers with that K-pop comment.
Hey, I've had to listen to more K-pop than I care to admit lately. And K-pop Demon Hunters was pretty impressive. But anyways, the point is that like there is a group of people who don't feel like we feel. Mm. They don't value quality.
True.
And they just don't care. And
but one can blame YouTube for that. I feel like the standard of production hit the floor when people started accepting millions of views off someone in their bathroom.
Counterpoint.
Okay. Yeah.
Is that the actual truth? Or is it just that people didn't care before? And so it's like, perfectly happy to watch this guy in his bathroom.
Yeah. Maybe you're right.
Like reality, right. To me, before AI, a big impact in the industry was reality TV. Right?
That's true.
Like all of a sudden it went from scripted dramas to just, especially in the 90s, like late 90s, early 2000s, reality TV, it fits the mold that we're talking about now.
Yeah.
It's cheap to make, it's a small crew, tons of editing. The editing is a freaking catastrophe. Yeah. And tracking of data. I worked on a bit of one behind the scenes kind of reality thing for a while. I was like, wow, this is a lot. But it essentially is cheap TV that I can replicate over and over again. And it's, to me, that's what created the influencer. Like,
yeah. Also, I mean, that was, it exploded in response to the strikes in 2007. I mean, you didn't need writers, you didn't need directors. You could just throw people in front of a camera and away you went. So, I mean, things like Survivor were already in existence, but they became more pop cops, like you're talking about from the 90s. But yeah, people doubled down because it was content they could fill a schedule with without having to deal with all the unions.
Gardening channels, like Food Network, like how many home renovation shows are there? It's insane. I mean, and those are different levels of polish. And, you know, essentially, I think YouTube more tapped into, let me give an example from my life here. So my father, I've worked in movies, all that kind of stuff. My dad was the guy who would go to the bargain bin and buy all the $1 action movie DVDs and watch them and then tell me, oh yeah, this was a pretty good movie. And I'm like, that is garbage. Like, it's horrible. And, you know, when I started in sound, I worked on some pretty low budget stuff. And the model there was just make stuff because, yeah, you know, eventually you'll maybe get one that's successful, but it's more about building your catalog. And you saw it in the streaming wars, build the catalog. Mm-hmm. I have all this IP. I have all this catalog. But there's a massive amount of people who will watch that stuff. They'll just watch it.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
They don't care.
There's like actually a cult following of those kinds of movies too. The schlockier, the better. Like,
that's the sort of meta version, but there's like, there's the meta, like hipster kind of version, but then there's the people who just watch it and go, "Nah, I needed to kill an hour."
Right.
And like, I was watching a lady on the train and she's just scrolling through dumb shit. Like, some of it's, I don't know, didn't know. I was just like, I was just watching her mesmerized. And I'm sure you could see me doing some version of it, but like TikTok and just dumb stuff for an hour.
Oh yeah. Time can fly when you're.
So this sort of like it's a little bit, I don't know, pompous isn't the right word, but a little bit like uppity to think that everyone cares about art as much as, in fact, like, I mean, throughout history, there's been fighting about how much you should care for art. And I don't even think we're necessarily, this is another hot take, I'm not sure we're necessarily always creating art.
No, almost guaranteed we're not.
Right. I know there's a tendency to sort of want to elevate ourselves to that level. And in many cases, that is true. We hit those levels of craft, I would say.
Or crap.
But I think in some ways, like, we've kind of been, you know, reading our own press a little bit.
Well, look, we contribute to the zeitgeist. At a minimum, we can say that, because that's an all-encompassing term that includes good and bad, for sure.
Yeah.
But getting back to the article, we talk a lot about how the sort of mechanical jobs are most at risk. And so likely some version of that will get rehoused in North America, because the overhead of sending small amounts of shots back and forth doesn't really make a lot of sense. There's kind of another version of this that does have an impact negatively in the West. I think that's to do with juniors and hiring junior people. It's less perhaps to do with AI and more to do with studios not having the patience to train juniors anymore because of the crunch on budgets and time. What's your experience with that?
Well, I think that's kind of been a problem. As soon as we start to ship that kind of work out, you have that kind of problem, right? It's like, so the reason to hire a junior employee, and I've talked to people like this, is like, either you're way cheaper, you bring, like, you have a, you know, if I've been working for 10 years, you know, you learn what you need to learn. But if you get a really eager kid out of school who's learned the latest thing and all this kind of, so in some ways, if those people know the AI tools better than the people who are maybe have better taste at this point, developed taste, they become kind of like a supercharger, right? And it doesn't matter if it was AI or whatever. It's like, oh, you just came out, you knew Houdini. Everybody's been using Maya for 5 years. We're switching to Houdini. Okay, that's cool. And also, you know this, and you've shot things, and, you know, whatever. So it depends where you kind of came out in that. Did you go to, like, I heard somebody refer to it as the VFX puppy mills, where they just like train people to learn software, or did you learn filmmaking? Did you go to like a film school or shoot your own films? That was something I always looked for, a bit of entrepreneurial spirit, especially in the smaller studios. You need people who are junior to not just expect to just sit on the box and learn. They have to kind of like to it. So that idea, I think, is now just industry-wide. If you want, it is going to be very much like when I started, like, there's no guarantee of a job coming out of school. It's a big decision. Yeah.
There was a time when, like, we would take any student who was left over at Sheridan College, for example, like, that's how desperate we were to grab new people.
The price of a Sheridan College graduate rose dramatically, mm-hmm. like post-pandemic or in that.
Yep.
And the problem is most of them can't really do anything. Like, they're super talented, lots of potential. The ones that could, like, just come in and do that job and show that it's done, great. But a lot of people, like, you're spending and it doesn't matter how much you're paying for them or how much talent they have, they're not professional yet. You know, like, it's different doing your own stuff on your own timeline where the teacher is going to be like, you're late, as opposed to, no, you're fired, you know?
And that's not hampered, only
you fired, we're all fired.
Yeah. And that's hampered, of course, by the sort of post-COVID remote work. Like, mm-hmm. personally, I'm a fan of the flexibility that provides. I've seen a lot of particularly middle-aged VFX artists benefit from being able to pick up their kids after school and then jump back on the box. And, you know, that flexibility, I think, is really good and gives VFX artists a crack at a family life that for, I think, decades we never had.
Yeah.
But by the same token, if you're on your own in your basement and you're not sitting next to a senior who can look over your shoulder and give you some mentorship, it's 10 times harder. I think while screen sharing helps to a limited extent, there's nothing like being in the trenches together to really amplify learning. So it's of course not impossible, and I think we've seen it work, but it's definitely a drag on people's growth.
Yeah, I think, you know, I agree. I'm a humongous proponent of remote work. It's been a massive benefit for me. It's actually, people always talk about the downsides of it, and I understand those, but there's also a lot of upside. Like, I can just chat with the editor at 11 o'clock at night going, oh, did it render? Okay, cool, we'll send it. You know, it's like, there's no friction there.
And I skew on that side too. I just think the one area where I think there's weakness is the training. Like, and it's so important to newcomers to the industry, which is increasingly becoming harder and harder to crack into, that it's just worth noting. That's all.
Yeah, for sure. It's definitely, and the best companies would try to do as much as possible to mitigate that. The best teams as well, right? But, you know, I think at the moment there's, the industry has created more workers than there are jobs, as evidenced by me not having a job right now. And until that, either they make more stuff or people leave the industry, retire out, I think it's going to, unless someone is looking for like a really cheap hire, it's going to be very difficult for junior people to find work unless they have a skill that other people don't have. Like, I can use AI to do this.
I think that's going to be the next wave of people who have that high level of AI familiarity. And again, like, we all know AI is a bad word, but like, it is a thing, and it's even the existence of it is a threat because the execs all think it can replace us. So it affects decision making, it affects timelines. You need to be aware, at least, that people think it can do all and be all.
That was a point that was brought up in the article, which I thought is often overlooked.
Yeah.
It's like I said, the perception of visual effects, it's the perception of AI as well.
Yeah.
So, like, I think it was maybe Mohsen who quoted it, but basically it's like, clients are like, well, can't you just do it with AI now? Which is like really flippant and kind of annoying. And you're like,
insulting. Oh,
And it's, God's sakes, you know?
Actually, I had two cases where companies came to us for bids. We bid and they said, oh, the company across the street is going to do it with AI for half the price. Well, they came back in a month because AI couldn't do it at half the price. And now they had half the budget left and no time. And it was a hard pass. Like, I think people are getting sold a bill of goods too on the client side.
100%.
And there's a lot of education that has to happen on the hard way.
It's going to shake itself out. I had the same problem with virtual production. Somebody said, we can do what those guys are doing for way cheaper, way faster. And I had to justify why, like, why they should still do it with us. And to do that, I had to show them what they're going to, like, because we had been looking into the same kind of technology, luckily. And we said, okay, well, this is what you're not going to get. And they were like, okay. But this is a client that I had a relationship with for 5 years, as opposed to somebody who's just shopping their work around. And everybody's under budget pressure now. And because right at the top, there's an expectation. Well, presumably you can do this cheaper. And also, even without AI, it's like the market isn't very good. So I should be able to push people's salaries down. Like, there's another thing about artists, and I don't like it either, but like, when it's booming, you can push your rate up. When it's not, if you can try to keep your rate, but you won't work as much. And I respect that. I know people who are like that. This is my rate. You can't pay me. Too bad. Cool. And it works for some people, but otherwise you got to adjust. And so, you know, this is, I think, a good topic of a future episode, which is like managing your money. And
even putting a big price tag on your head puts you in the crosshairs when things go bad. Like, you know, if you're looking across an apartment, they always look for the one with the most zeros to focus on.
I would always
sometimes those individuals are worth it because they're just that good. That's a fact. But you know, sometimes, as we saw during the pandemic squeeze, people are getting promoted very quickly outside of their skill set. People are getting hired with thin resumes and pretty senior positions. And that's great when there's desperation, but when the dust settles and people have to cut costs, you know, those are the first deals that they try to evacuate, you know?
Yeah. And the unfortunate thing, I don't know that it's fair. I've had implications of that too, where the technology is such that the technology is a barrier to entry. So people who are just more talented in different ways than you can't get in. And so you get the opportunity, but as soon as that's removed, the people who make the coolest stuff quickest win. Right. Hmm. Like, and so you'll see that in where it's the most technical, rotoscope tracking, back to that stuff, layout, even like camera work. Like, the right now 3D layout is a technical exercise. It's a creative exercise as well. Camera work is a creative exercise. But there's a lot of like setting things up for future departments and built into that step. And I feel like, you know, at some point that will get easier, and then it'll be like whoever's the best camera person, not the best layout artist. And so, you know, and if you can, even the artists have complained over time. Well, you know, like, you hear this, well, lighting gave me this and comp gave me this and,
this.
And they talk about people in like monolithic departments. It's like, well, that's Jim and that's Carla. So, you know, I would try to do that, but it's that segmentation. So if all of a sudden you're doing all that stuff. So the first kind of like in recent times, Unreal was like, oh, that's going to start to unlock it. We can do one lighting setup and do everything. And then you're like, that's not exactly it. AI is right in the mix of that. Mm-hmm. But on top of the industry problems, there's also like the rest of the world. So like, sure, it can not just impact the artists, it can in production, like it can take notes for you in meetings, and then you don't need to hire a coordinator. And then like, so it's the same thing with the rotoscope, like the need for a coordinator or a PA is much less than it used to be. I haven't worked with a second person in a year. I've been doing all the jobs, producer and visual effects supervisor, with a small team, because, you know, there's not enough work for them to do, or I can do it easy enough.
Yeah.
And that's going to get, you know, better and better.
We've talked quite a bit about doom and gloom, but there's some bright spots to end on. And one of them is for the foreign markets, the India, South Korea, Philippines, Latin America. One of the things that in my paper that's coming out shortly, it will be free, by the way, we're going to giving it away as a provocative thought piece. I'm just updating it to put the final touches on it. One of the things that came across, which was a surprise to me, is that during the strikes, the spending actually didn't go down. We talked a little bit about this on the first one. It went to other places. And so basically everyone in North America who needs Netflix or wants Netflix has that opportunity, but it's not true in South Korea, it's not true in India. So Netflix is cutting all these deals to make homegrown content in those markets and then potentially bring them back to North America. So we've seen a lot of K-pop type stuff come back, a lot of Indian and Latin American material coming through. So I think, and you know, Bollywood's the perennial example of this. They make more content than Hollywood does. So I think while there might be a sacrifice in the short term, while the road of work that powered the growth of the industry goes away, there's going to be a lot more opportunities for domestic production in your own verticals, in your own markets that are perhaps more interesting and more compelling. So I would recommend upskilling to the extent you can. If you can get away from some of these core mechanical tasks and work into something creative, you're going to have a lot more options. And for the North American people, we're seeing for the first time a box office blip. It's gone up. Q1 of this year was 23% better than Q1 last year. Basically, Project Hail Mary outperformed everyone's expectations and carried Q1 to a really solid number. It was followed up with the Mario movie, Mario Galaxy, or whatever it's called, made a bajillion dollars at the box office. And so now people are forecasting that, you know, in 2026, it's conceivable we'll hit $100 billion domestic box office in North America, which is something that people thought was now a thing of the past. So there's some more demand coming. I think butts in seats is important. They're showing a lot of growth, and Gen Z, in fact, going to the theaters. It's something that they didn't expect, and is actually kind of a shocking reflection. We all thought they'd given up on film, but here they are. They're the first ones back, and that market is growing faster than everybody else. So, if this positive momentum continues, you know, we can build on what's been a strong Q1. Maybe we see, you know, a strong year in the end. Certainly, I think the entertainment business has done the best historically in times of strife. And I think there's lots of strife and nonsense around the world. People want to unplug and have fun and smile. And so maybe this is the year that things start to click again. And, you know, as we know, Hollywood's just a big business. And once the shareholders start seeing some value and we start seeing stock prices go up, I think the appetite for doing more and maybe even more innovative content is going to return. I think, Spielberg just said it last week, like, we need to get away from the retreads and the IP mining because audience are sick of it. We need to see new stories again. And I think if we look, you know, we look back to the 70s and maybe the 90s, you know, smaller budget, more creative movies, more of them, maybe that's the answer to this sort of blockbuster fatigue we're facing. And maybe that creates a new genre, a new level of filmmaking we haven't seen in a long time. So let's aspire to have some more of that.
Yeah, I wonder if it's like, you know, we're getting back to, like, not so much, I don't want to talk about quality and all that kind of stuff, because I think that's very subjective. But I think, you know, you can only, I see it in sports a lot right now, like Toronto's about to host the World Cup. There's a million Toronto FC matches. There's the women's team matches. Then they're doing like legends matches. There's only so much soccer I can go to. Do you know what I mean? So yeah, it's like a fire hose. And it was the same with, like, okay, there's a Marvel movie, there's a Star Wars movie, there's a Marvel show. Yeah. It's like, well, I love all of it. However, I cannot, there's a point where it's like, oh, I haven't even seen that one.
And you can't appreciate it after a while. It's just too much.
Yeah. So maybe it's about, you know, stopping the sprint, and maybe that's part of it. Do you think that's part of it?
I think that's totally part of it. I think and I think they use this perhaps as cover, but I think it actually is true. Like, they were just making so much content that it was hard to keep track of where it was at in each particular instance, and so it let some weakness creep into the system, and not the volume just didn't lend itself to the kind of quality that they were really aspiring to. So I think now that they've cut the volume, the focus is on quality. And I think they're trying to make more universal stories, which I think is a move in the right direction too. And, you know, let's hope that audiences connect.
Yeah. I wonder if, too, like, having been subjected, as I'm sure many are who are in my position, like, what do? I look on if you click something about AI, you'll get like 400 hacks to do Claude, blah, 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 blah. If you click on like how to do a drop shipping business, it'll be like, boom. It's like anytime you click on anything now, the algorithm just fires a fire hose at you. And one of the things I've seen is like, make an automatic content generation system, you know, and there's one that's in the news because like some guys in Holland made Alberta separatist stuff because, and that's like the most sort of outrageous use of it. But anyways, like, so at some point, I've heard other people talk about the dead internet,
where,
where nothing on the internet will be real. It's already close, I think.
I think
so maybe a return to the movies or even streaming or whatever would be at least seen as more legitimate again.
Well, I think we were seeing a trend of like to analog, right, with the younger generation. They want VHS tapes and they want records and, you know,
and no quaint, AI, very much no, no in my
very
house.
Much no AI. And I think that's a flag for these AI companies because they're supposed to be the consumers of this once we age out. But it's pretty fascinating the sort of antiquated things that they're pushing towards, and it makes perfect sense. They see the job reductions and they don't want any part of it. So
what you're saying in closing is we should all take our employment checks and go and watch movies in the theater.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep. Save yourself.
And pick the most expensive VFX movie and watch it twice so that we can all return to work.
There you go. Okay, well, you heard it here, everybody. Thanks for watching. And yeah, like, subscribe, all that kind of stuff, and go watch movies, please.
Bye for now.
Bye. I'm so sorry.